when we put in known quantities here. So the standard curves there for both the foraging and the ITS gene. And here's the results in terms of the insects. So what we have is a difference in transcript level for the female from the variant colony. And again, it's not huge, but this is about a 10% difference, 10-20% difference is what's seen in the Drosophila as well. Going back to the Drosophila gene, we have a large gene here, which is reduced in size by splicing out the introns to give a message that's about 4.5 kb in size. And so we had begun then by taking a small portion of that gene by doing homology-based amplifications. We did another round of those kinds of amplifications to try to get more of the gene. But as we got out to the ends here, the homology-based approach broke down, and so we had to use 5' and 3' race in order to capture the ends. In Drosophila, there are actually two genes, only one which is really the foraging gene, and as I mentioned before, there are a number of different transcripts that come from that foraging gene. And so we were also interested in looking at the polymorphism, or the range of transcripts that there might be, and also whether there are multiple genes. Certainly from the first part here, from our amplification, we found that there are, in fact, different kinds of transcripts. And these fragments here all add up to something that looks very much like the foraging gene in Drosophila, but down here we also found a transcript that had a totally different sequence fused to this region here. And so, in fact, we think it might be coming from a pseudogene, or is just a totally different splicing reaction. We don't know. But so here we have lined up three different cDNAs. And you can see in this region where we started off the cloning, there's high homology. As we go up here, then less so. Two transcripts here are very similar, but one is quite different, as I mentioned before already. In the end, when we piece it all together, we have a sequence which looks very much like the foraging gene in Drosophila. We have a coiled-coil region for the protein-protein interaction, the cyclic GMP binding region domain here, and the kinase domain. So essentially, when you translate the sequence that we do have, it looks very much like the gene that I described at the beginning. And it's when you look at the sequence in terms of what's its nearest neighbor, it's most closely related to the silkworm sequence. If you do a southern blot, looking at genomic DNA now, with the probe to the kinase region here, you in fact have two hybridization spots, both for the, so here and here. So in fact there might be two copies of this gene in the genome. There seems to be a bit of a polymorphism here. I don't know exactly what that means, but that's what we observed so far. Okay, also complicating the issue, as I mentioned before, there are multiple transcripts, and the original real-time PCR was based on primers in a region that was highly homologous, in the region where they're all similar. So then we redesigned primers to try to capture differences between those transcripts so that we could distinguish the real transcript from that pseudo transcript that I mentioned before. And when we did that, then we got, again, the same difference between normals and variants, again, in the females. and so, and the difference is a little bit better there between the normals and the variants. Another issue is whether this gene expression is developmentally dependent. And so here we're looking at expression in third instar larva, 2-week-old adults and 4-week-old adults here. You can see that In all of those cases, the variant is always higher than the normal, but the two-week-old adults have overall the highest levels of the expression of this gene. This is just the ANOVA that emphasizes the development, the importance of the developmental stage and the difference between the normal and the variant insects. And finally then, we really want to get down to something that is diagnostic. And when we compare the DNA sequence for the variant versus the normal, we do have a two nucleotide difference that affects the region that's involved in the protein-protein interaction between the normal and the variant. We still need to confirm this on many more samples to see whether it is diagnostic, totally diagnostic, but it's intriguing that it's there. So, taking a risk at the beginning, focusing on one gene, if nothing else has given us an interesting insight into this particular gene and how it differs in expression in the development of the insect. It makes a lot of sense in terms of its connection to behavior traits in other insects, but obviously more work needs to be done to confirm whether in fact this is absolutely diagnostic for the variant. I think I've mentioned these things before. I just want to acknowledge the student here, Chris Knight, was involved in the original work on the rapids, and Frey is the postdoc who did the most of the work that I talked about today. And we received funds initially from Monsanto and also from the University of Guelph to do this work. Okay, thank you.
We've heard a lot about Western corn rootworm today, and I just wanted to point out to start with that this is the only rootworm species that I'm going to be talking about in this talk. So if I refer to rootworms, this is the species I'm talking about. This is the key pest in the United States, and this is where a lot of the target control techniques have been developed to combat this pest over time. Research on this insect has really increased in recent years, and I've listed three reasons why, and I think all of these have been addressed today at one level or another in this symposium. Adaptation to management practices. We have a corn rootworm variant in the eastern corn belt. We have insecticide resistance that has occurred multiple times, especially in the western corn belt. Nick talked about Western cornworm as an invasive species in Europe earlier today. And then development of new technologies, rootworm protected BT corn. And this is the one that I'm going to be addressing today. Currently, we have four events that have been now registered and that are commercially available and have been planted in the U.S. corn belt. And all of these have come on board just since 2003, so this is a fairly recent turn of events, and new technologies are coming along fairly rapidly that we're trying to mesh with the conventional technologies that are already out there for corn rootworm management. Because of these new events that were being developed especially, we've needed to develop a finer scale knowledge of diabrotica biology and ecology. And specifically, we've needed to understand BT corn and diabrotica interactions, the effects of the plant on the insect, and also the effect of the insect on the corn. What type of efficacy are we seeing? And then, because there are EPA mandated IRM plans that have to go in with each registration, there's a lot of new data that we needed to collect to be able to optimize and develop resistance management plans. So that's partly where some of the work that I'm going to talk about today fits in. as you've already seen in some of the previous talks, all of those events that are currently available will generate some adults. So some adults will survive. And so one of the questions that I've been working on over time is to try to understand if exposure to rootworm-protected BT events, either in the larval and or adult stages, can